Yeah, this novel came out in February, but the paperback just came out last week. It's called Scorper. And I believe there might be a few scorpers around. You might think of something like that sailing hook, but smaller, used to engrave woodcuts after a first line is made so that the print and ink adheres. So it's a rather pretentious name. I apologize for that. But roughly speaking, it's about an American researching his ancestry in Sussex. And I'll just read from the first couple of pages, then skip ahead when a little bit more of the action occurs. So, Scorper. You're on your way to Ditchling. It's a Thursday afternoon in late March, during the unfortunate year of 2012. The year the bookshops are closing, and the libraries are downsizing, and the internet attempts its final stranglehold on the written word. You are an American. You're on a vacation in the land of your English ancestors. The U.S. economy teeters on the edge of another recession. And you'd better be back at work in a couple of weeks, or you'll lose your job. Leaving Heathrow, you find yourself in the hands of your rental car's satellite navigator. She guides you out of the parking lot. She directs you to the motorway. 2 hours in the company of her authoritative female voice pass without incident. Then, deep in Sussex, she tells you to exit the motorway onto a series of narrow roads. A sign says South Downs National Park. It's difficult to see because it's raining. At a roundabout, you miss your turn and go around in circles, clinging to the outer lane like a sock in a dryer. The navigator loses patience. She orders you through a maddening sequence of additional roundabouts, up a steep hill and down an empty road toward a patch of gravel. You have reached your destination, the navigator says. You leave the engine running and step outside. After the 11-hour flight from Los Angeles and the long drive in your rental car, being out in the elements has an invigorating effect. The rain needles your face, soaks your shirt, and finds its way into your shoes. A fence, maybe a gate, waits in the distance. Your khakis flapping in the wind, you make your way to what is indeed a metal gate. You place your hands on the cold crossbar and hold on. A derelict chalk pit stretches before you, mounds of grass pitted with white craters. This is an abandoned place, the bed of an ancient ocean. Rainwater fills the craters and overflows luminescent and milky white, like lava bubbling out of volcanoes. Your conception of time expands. Recently, you turned 30. Naturally, you feel old in the company of children, but often you feel too young, especially in the company of more mature men, the ones with respected professions, wives, or domestic partners, not to mention children or pets. You've always wanted a respected profession. A partner remains improbable. In the past, your friends have said you're not bad-looking, but these were your adolescent friends, the ones you're no longer technically friends with. Recent acquaintances have told you to your face that you are, at best, a Stone Age throwback. It has to do with the size of your head. Some cows have smaller heads. You're tall, 6'6" to be exact, and your dirty blonde hair sticks out in tufts and clumps. At the holiday office party, a female co-worker came over to you in her heels. She stood up on her tiptoes, a glass of red wine in one hand and a glass of white in the other, and she drunkenly surveyed your face. "Tell you what," she said, "you're like Frankenstein, but cute." You get back in your rental car and drive, away from the gate, back down the hill. At the nearest petrol station, you park and run inside for directions. The man at the counter has never heard of Ditchling. "Ditchling," you say, a little louder. Maybe it's my accent. "Ditchling, any chance you can help me find it?" The man nods. "It's nearby. The bone ash works, I think. I'm sorry? The bone ash works, I think. Bone ash works? For what? We sell road maps, he says, pointing to the stack beside the register. I think Ditchling is just after the bone ash works. You buy a map and return to your car. After unpeeling the plastic wrapping and folding the pages and prying apart the unwieldy tight creases, the thin plastic spiders down your wrist, you cannot rid yourself of it. You smash the map with repeated blows of your fist and leave it crumpled on the seat beside you. The windows of your rental car have steamed up. Your forehead against the steering wheel, you give yourself a moment to relax, to return your breathing to normal, then set out again. You obtain directions from farmers and postal workers. Everyone you encounter is just as polite as you'd heard they would be. Even though you're lost, you cannot deny that it is slightly thrilling speaking English to people in England. The sign Bone Ash Works appears, along with a picture of a small truck. Then there is a sign for a nature reserve, followed by a smaller wooden sign that points to a gap in the hedgerow, Ditchling. You hesitate on the road, your signal flashing. The gap is barely wide enough for your car. Slowly, you turn into the narrow lane under an archway of trees. The sun, for a moment, disappears. The road sinks further and further still, and the horizon falls away as you plunge down into the darkness before emerging into the sunlight again. There is a stone war memorial. Behind this memorial stands the village. The church with its conical spire, the high street bordered by flint walls, the Tudor houses and shops. The surrounding hills are misty and green and dotted with sheep. There is a windmill, a beacon. You drive slowly past the war memorial. The cobblestones under your tires have been pounded smooth by centuries of rain. You drive tentatively, shoulders hunched over the steering wheel. A sign beside an empty pond says, "Do not feed the ducks." The sign has a picture of a duck and an outstretched human hand with a line drawn through it. All the houses along the high street have their curtains drawn. Iron railings protect their gardens. The shops under the Tudor houses seem to huddle together, a jeweler's, a greengrocer's, a post office, a cafe. The church oversees a sprawling, well-populated graveyard. At the end of the high street, a pub called the Lantern occupies its own corner. The pub has a chimney, tar-blackened walls, a swinging sign of a glowing handheld lantern. There are pots of flowers around the perimeter and small circular windows that look like portholes. The road rises up to a village hall, then splits into even narrower lanes. You turn back round over the cobblestones, searching for your B&B. Yours is the only moving vehicle on the road. A few pedestrians scurry into their homes or disappear along the footpath between stone walls. Ditchling seems designed for ducking and whispering. Right, I'll skip forward a couple of days. Nothing much happens in those days, by the way. He finds out that he is indeed an ancestor of someone from Ditchling, and he's ignored, more or less, as he makes these inquiries. And he becomes slightly more unraveled than he already is. And then he goes to sleep and wakes up early in the morning because of geese. The geese keep honking. It's just after 5, and they seem to be circling, dive-bombing the B&B in waves until everyone inside is forced to run. You have 3 hours before Sheila's breakfast. Sheila's the landlady. Maybe you can catch Ditchling off guard. You creep downstairs, guided by the nightlight at the bottom of the landing. It feels vaguely criminal, sneaking out of the B&B before the appointed hour for breakfast. You unlock the front door and close it with the faintest of clicks. The village sleeps in darkness. Have the geese gone? You zip up your coat and sneak down the high street in the opposite direction of the pub. You pass Boddington's Lane and a wider road appears, and you sprint the length of it, turning now and then to see if any windows light up in the houses, if anyone is watching. At the end of the road, larger houses wrap around a cul-de-sac. There are more street lamps in this neighborhood, and the front gardens are strewn with children's toys. This is where the ditchlings reproduce. You cannot help it. You must get closer to their doors and their bedrooms. At a low front gate, you climb over without a sound. In the garden, a plastic gnome stands beside a flower pot. Empty milk bottles lined up like infantry wait for the milkman. Here it is at last, the real England. The gnome, the flower pot, the milk bottles. You pick up the pot and smell the damp soil. You hold a bottle to your cheek and shiver with joy at the coldness, the goodness, the promise of fresh, white milk. Even in a world saturated with e-readers, tradition lives on. These ditchlings have tried to hide the evidence, but you have found it. A man only has to get up early to learn the truth. You're still at the door beside the gnome when another squadron of geese flies overhead, raising the alarm. Honk! 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 You spin in a circle, trapped. You put the bottle back in formation and hurry to the shadows behind the gate. The American is awake, the geese honk. He's out in your garden. You squat on your heels and hope these milk-drinking ditchlings are heavy sleepers. When the birds have passed, you jump the gate and run back to the high street. Overhead, a lone goose lags behind the others. The bird labors in the air, flapping pitifully, its face pinched against the black sky. Its trajectory drops, then drops further still, and you must follow this bird. You must find its pond. Running hard, you pass the war memorial and down into the flats. You reach the gap in the hedgerow and emerge onto the road you took 2 days ago, driving from London. The goose has become a distant smudge. You run past grazing pastures with the cows slowly taking shape in the shadows. A sign stands over a gravel road. Moorcroft Nature Reserve. Tea Room. April to September. There are illustrations of various waterfowl on the signs. Ducks, moorhens, geese. This is the poor creature's pond. You can smell it. Across the car park, you find an entrance heading into the wall of trees. A gate blocks the path, and you climb it without difficulty. You make your way in a dim light up a short hill. At the end of the tree line, the path emerges onto an open field. The wet grasses and reeds are glistening with dew. In the distance lies the pond. The geese have congregated. They are quiet. There must be over 100 of them down at the water, filling the near bank like tufted brush strokes of white on a gloomy canvas. You stand back in the tall grass, struck. This has always been what gets you weak-kneed. The sight of birds floating in the water, shielding each other from the wind. The whole scene reminds you of England. The pond at dawn, the geese, the encircling trees. You have caught nature at rest, long before it puts on its mask. You come closer to the pond, as close as you dare. The birds are seemingly indifferent to your approach. Perhaps they're asleep. You have turned the tables on ditchling, and now it's time to turn the tables on the geese. Remember me? At the bank, you squat beside the water and whisper so the creatures won't be alarmed. Sometimes a man must be a hunter in his own motherland. When you flew over, I was the one who woke up. You try to offer reassurances. Inching forward, you court them with whispers until you reach out and snatch the nearest by the throat. The goose flaps its wings and kicks, but you've got it. You wade back into the reeds while the others honk and splash. They fly over to the far bank and resettle there, leaving you alone with your new friend. You're mine now. You hold its beak down in the reeds. With your other hand, you hold his little legs tight. The goose has a frightened black face, pretty white feathers that you'd like to pluck. There are holes along the side of its beak, venting air in wet, desperate bursts. You look into its round black eyes and find the Sussex you've been waiting for, the home of sensitive plants and animals, the Albion fields of creatures who love poetry. The goose struggles to be free. You can feel its warm, rubbery skin expanding and contracting under its feathers. It doesn't understand that you don't want to kill it. I listened to you as you flew over, remember? Now it's time for you. Let me tell you a story. Do you know what I did the first time a boy at school made fun of the way I looked and a girl laughed? The goose fixes its eyes on you with an expression of sympathy. I ran home. I snuck upstairs to my room and I tried to draw a picture of my pain. It didn't look anything like what I felt, so I tried to write poems. The goose squirts little gusts of wet air. Don't you wish you could read and write? You move the beak up and down. It stops flapping and kicking because it's learned how to listen. In college, I studied art and English literature. I read Shelley and Tennyson and Byron. I gained a great deal of respect for your people. Almost 10 years as a copy editor, and how long could a man do it? You probably think it's silly me telling you this, but I swear. You lower your head over the goose so that your lips almost touch its beak. I swear, you'll soon see what I'm capable of. Twigs snap back among the trees. A man is coming to the pond. You release the goose and lie flat on your stomach. The sun conspires against you, turning the sky ever lighter shades of gray. What if the warden has come? Pond water penetrates your clothes. Beside you, the faithful goose opens and closes its beak, probably stunned. Maybe it's reluctant to fly away from its new friend. On the other hand, the bird could be acting the part of the faithful companion in order to betray you later. You elbow its wing, and the goose flies off, honking toward its companions on the other side of the pond. The man has almost reached the water's edge, a stone's throw from your position. He's carrying a fishing pole. Still in your stomach, you track him through the reeds. It's Kevin. You've seen him before in the pizza shop. He's wearing waders, a mesh fishing jacket, a hat with fur ear flaps. You can't deny that Kevin's handsome. He has a dimpled chin and the kind of nose found on the heads of Roman coins. As the sun emerges over the pond, you turn onto your side, your head in your palm, and watch him tie off. He casts. He whips the line across the water, and he makes the lure dance. In another life, Kevin would have been a typical American. He would have been born into a sporting family from Montana, a dynasty of renegade Republicans who hate government, drive SUVs, and hang stuffed elk heads from their living room walls. His bookshelves would have proudly held the novels of Hemingway and Norman Mailer, perhaps a biography of Andrew Jackson, abridged for easy reading. It's all becoming clear. Kevin has real problems. Something must have happened to create his sneer. In his role-playing fantasies, he alternates between Land Rovers and holidays in Disneyland wearing mouse ears. How similar you are to Kevin, after all. You're both Americans in England. Poor little boors trying to fit in. You had been rather hard on him in the pizza shop, suggesting he had a poor imagination. Wouldn't it do to make friends? It's time to express yourself openly, to dispense with formalities. Kevin casts over some lily pods. His back turns, and then you cast stand up out of the reeds. Morning, Kevin. Beautiful day. Kevin ducks as if he'd been shot. He lets out a kind of girlish cry, arms thrown up around his head. He stays crouched in the reed a moment, looking at you. What the hell? He stands up with his fishing pole. What are you doing here? You point across the pond at the geese. They woke me up. I thought I'd go for a walk. Kevin looks across the water. It's not fair. All the geese have gone to sleep, and they don't look capable of anything but silence. He comes wading across the weeds. You try to convince yourself as he comes closer and closer that he's going to stop soon. When he throws down his pole, you know it's too late to run. Liar, Kevin says. He shoves you down into the reeds. What are you doing here? Tell me the truth. You squirm at his feet like a snake. I am telling the truth. You're up to something. Out here without a hat, spying. Please, I don't have a hat. The geese woke me up and I followed them to the pond. You climbed the gate? Yes. Without a hat. Kevin looks round the reserve, gesturing at the trees. Who leaves before dawn without a hat? disgusting bloody artists. All the same, get up and fight. Nobody has ever called me an artist. I'll bash your head in. I'll cut off your hands and bury them in the ground. Please, you don't have to worry about me, Kevin. I won't tell anyone you were fishing in the reserve. You're damn right you won't. He takes a handkerchief from his mess jacket and blows his nose. For a moment, he looks out over the pond, eyes hardening. He's still flustered from being taken by surprise. It's your vulnerability lying there in the reeds that only eggs him on. I'd better not see you out here again, he says. You won't, I promise. He kicks you in the ribs. And he kicks you again, so hard it makes you cry out. I won't let you off this easy next time. Kevin picks up his pole, and he heads back toward the tree line, shoulders squared, head thrust forward with his ear flaps swinging. Your side feels broken apart. You try to stand and fall wheezing onto your back. Slowly, your breath returns to your lungs. Up in the sky, you see the geese. They have left the pond in an enormous V, off toward the South Downs, in the opposite direction of Ditchling. Thank you.